From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because truth matters, life matters more. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man, we pick up where we ended on our previous broadcast and present more of an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank is talking with Dr. Paul Gould, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Palm Beach Atlantic University and author of A Good and True Story, 11 Clues to Understanding Our Universe and Your Place in It. Let's now join Hank Hanegraaff and Paul Gould in their conversation.
Sometimes you hear the argument, the immensity of the universe makes us meaningless. But in reality, I think that if we only lived for 70, 80 years, being around for a short period of time in an immense universe may point to our meaninglessness. But the fact is, we were created for eternity. We're not just exploring this universe for a short period of time, but forever. I think just as we never come to an end of exploring the immensity of God, so we'd never come to an end of exploring the immensity of the universe which he created. And he's going to recreate the universe now, Paul says, groans in travail, awaiting its liberation from decay. And this is going to be restored, and we're going to spend an eternity exploring God and God's created handiwork.
Yeah, I've actually got a lot of sympathy for that. That sounds about right to me, right? These are some of the great questions that we all have, right? What will we be doing in the new heavens and the new earth? But there is this proposal. Actually, one of the books I edited, The Story of the Cosmos, Gonzalo, I can't say his name without looking
Guillermo.
At it, but yeah, there you go. Guillermo Gonzalez. Yeah. He wrote a chapter on the exoplanets and, you know, the question of, are there other planets that are Earth-like where we could find possible life? But in there, he actually ran that proposal that what we will be doing in the eschaton is interstellar travel, which we'll have plenty of time, right? And exploring the universe around us. And I resonate with that. I mean, obviously we're speculating, but there's something that seems profoundly right about that. When you ask questions like, why this universe, and why is the universe the way it is? And why is it so immense that we don't even have, we have all these distinctions that we need to make, right? We have the observable universe and the unobservable universe. Now, astronomers are talking about the affectable universe, right? Even if we can observe it, we can't affect all of it from where we sit today on Earth, given current technology, but who knows in the eschaton.
Let's talk about life, a very important Karen signpost in your book. I think that it probably does us well to consider the fact that in the non-religious story, there's this idea that nothing creates everything, that life comes from non-life, and that the life that comes from non-life produces metaphysical realities. In the religious story, we say we have to ask a question, and that question is, what is life and what constitutes life?
Right. I mean, life itself is an amazing feature of the world, right? And again, it's something that we only are aware of in one place, in a very humdrum galaxy in the middle of, you know, a cluster of galaxies in some corner of the universe. And so there is this question, what is so special about this place that life, number one, arose? And it does, of course, beg this preliminary question, what is life? And actually, in all the chapters in this book, because of this, you know, Aristotle's thought that we must ask the right preliminary questions. In every chapter, I usually begin with, you know, what is the nature of the thing in question that we're looking at? And so I spend a great bit of time in the beginning here. What is the nature of life, right? Is it what biology tells us, you know, and kind of look at some of that and kind of arrive at a philosophical definition that seems helpful, because in getting to the nature of life, it actually gives us a clue, I think, about how life came about. So,
yeah. So how did life begin? What's the problem for the view that life comes from non-life?
Oh, yeah. I mean, so, you know, you're right. If the non-religious story and all those kind of philosophical presuppositions that I mentioned earlier is true, somehow you got to get life from non-life with natural processes. And that has a number of hurdles. It's so interesting in the literature on this. You have kind of dueling confidence, right? You have those from a non-religious perspective that are very confident that it's just sort of a math problem and that we're eventually going to figure out how we get life from non-life. And then you have others like Jim Tor, who's one of the leading, you know, synthetic chemists in the world, who's saying, you're all lying. Nobody knows how life can come from non-life. You know, it's an incredibly intractable problem. And so it's hard for like the non-scientist to kind of know what to do with that. But there's at least three problems that are really seem intractable for the purely naturalistic explanation on the non-religious story. And that would be like the location question, like where did life begin, right? Again, we only know one location that has life, and that's the Earth. And so there's all these postulations, where would Darwin's little warm pond be? And there's a number, there's about 8 to 10 earthly suggestions, and then some punt to outer space. Maybe it came from outer space or asteroids or things like that. So that's a problem, though. Nobody really knows, number one. But number two, there's what I call in the book the ingredients problem, right? How do we get the basic building blocks for life from purely naturalistic processes, right? We need proteins, we need genetic material, we need lipids, we need all these sort of subparts of these macromolecules. And no origin of life experiment has been able to produce any of the macromolecules at all. They've been able to get some of the subparts, but the way that they set up the experiments, they weren't, you know, realistic with respect to early Earth atmosphere and early Earth conditions. So yeah, the location problem, the ingredients problem. And then even if you were to get these ingredients, you have the assembly problem. Because as we know now, right, the more we learn from science, the cell, which, you know, the first living organism was a single cell. Cells are incredibly complex machines. Many times people use the metaphor of a factory to explain the cell. And so you have all these problems with how do you assemble the cell, even if you had all the basic parts. And when you run the numbers on these things, it just seems intractable, given purely naturalistic and blind processes.
Yeah. So if you were to summarize this cairn, this signpost, what would you say? What's the significance of the life issue?
Yeah, I think that we had this intuition that life is something incredibly valuable. We even would use the word sacred. You know, when we're pre-philosophical, apart from being told by some, you know, view out there, our intuition, our pre-philosophical intuition is that there's something very special, even sacred about life, that it ought to be protected. You can run thought experiments about this, right? Imagine a world just like ours, except that we eradicate all living beings, right? I think the intuition is fairly clear that that would be a world of lesser value, right? And so here we have something of incredible value that is easy to destroy, but we have no idea how to produce it, how it came about. And so given the sacredness of this phenomena, again, it cries out for explanation, right? That's what's so significant about life, I think.
Yeah, and that leads me to the third cairn, or the third signpost, which is species. Darwin wrote a book, The Origin of Species. Here you have a chapter which points out that Darwin's tree of life is uprooted by the Cambrian radiation or the Cambrian explosion. So you have biology's Big Bang. That's very important to the religious story, just like cosmology's Big Bang is.
Right. Yeah. And this was an interesting chapter. You know, in some circles, it's become really hard to talk about evolution and to do it sort of, you know, charitably and with sort of intellectual humility. But if you kind of set that aside for a minute and just think about the sheer diversity of life. So we talked about life and this intuition that it's something of great value. When you add to that the fact that the diversity of life that we've had on Earth is incredible. In fact, like this really sobering statistic as I was researching for this chapter was 99% of all species that have existed have become extinct, right? And that's again, mind-boggling how much diversity this world has seen since life began. Yeah, so to your question, we have one of the lines of evidence that's often debated when it comes to what explains the diversity of life, right? Is it evolution and Darwin or neo-Darwinian accounts? Or is there some sort of like a need for God to infuse information in the causal joints to get the species? One of the pieces of evidence has been the fossil record because of, as you just talked about, biology's Big Bang. We have this period in time where you have this sudden appearance of many, many life forms, fully formed, without any appearance of transitional forms that, you know, would help the evolutionary story. And so this becomes something that's, again, what best explains the data, right? And so I didn't actually, I had a section in the book on the fossil record and kind of walking through the different options. And I took it out at the last moment because it was getting too technical. I mean, I just wanted to focus on the microbiology and the genetic kind of lines of evidence. But when it comes to the fossil record, you have, you know, when Darwin wrote in 1859 and he continued to revise The Origin of Species, he says, you know, right now the fossil record is substantially incomplete and it doesn't reveal any transitional forms. But if in some future date, when we do have the full or complete fossil record and we still don't have those transitional forms, that would cause problems for my theory, right? He basically says this. Well, now fast forward 150 plus years, and we basically have a pretty good fossil record. You know, I think we've discovered not everything, I'm sure, but, you know, we have a good idea of what it is. And we still see stasis and, you know, the fact that we don't have these sort of transitional forms. So we have these fully formed creatures without any obvious genetic link. And so I actually think that the best explanation for that is the sudden appearance that, you know, something like a special creationist would argue that God basically infused at different times in history new body plans, new information, and created new species.
Don't go away. In just a few moments, we'll rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Professor Paul Gould. In his book, A Good and True Story, philosopher Paul Gould guides you on a rewarding journey to discover the true story of the world and our place in it, showing that Christianity holds the most satisfying answers to life's biggest questions. A Good and True Story is a wonderful book to give to an unbelieving friend or family member. To receive your copy of A Good and True Story, 11 Clues to Understanding Our Universe and Your Place in It, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. Dr. Eben Alexander's wildly popular near-death experience book, Proof of Heaven, assures us that no matter what we do in this life, only unconditional love and joy await us in the world to come. But our Lord warned that while the gate to hell is wide, the road to it broad, and those who enter through it are many, the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few. Your generous support lets Hank Hanegraaff and CRI speak out against the lies that lead to hell. In appreciation for your gift today, we'll rush you Hank's book, Afterlife, What You Need to Know About Heaven, the Hereafter, and Near-Death Experiences, filled with answers to your questions about life after death. Call 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org now. Again, that's equip.org. Bertrand Russell famously said, "Most people would rather die than think, and many of them do." Not so with CRI support team members. Support team members are not only serious thinkers, but their membership in CRI's support team helps to equip hundreds of thousands of fellow believers around the globe each and every month. Are you not a member? Then you're missing out. Not only do support team members form the backbone of Christian Research Institute's outreaches, but they enjoy their selection of resources from our Equipping Essentials library and receive a complimentary subscription to CRI's award-winning Christian Research Journal, just two of the benefits of membership. To discover how you can make a difference 24/7 in equipping believers at home and abroad to stand for life and truth, check out the benefits of membership at equip.org. The Complete Bible Answer Book, Collector's Edition, Revised and Updated, is a comprehensive collection of the most often asked as well as most difficult questions Hank Hanegraaff has received in nearly three decades of hosting the Bible Answer Man broadcast. This expanded edition contains new entries, leading readers to a better understanding of God and our relationship to Him in Jesus Christ. The Complete Bible Answer Book Collector's Edition, Revised and Updated, is a comprehensive, handy, and attractive volume that you will return to again and again. Take your exploration of God's Word to new heights and receive the Revised and Updated Complete Bible Answer Book as our thank you for your gift by calling 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. Let's rejoin Bible Answer Man host Hank Hanegraaff and his guest, philosopher Paul Gould, in their conversation.
We basically have a pretty good fossil record, and we still see stasis, and we don't have these transitional forms. So we have these fully formed creatures without any obvious genetic link. And so I actually think that the best explanation for that is the sudden appearance that, you know, something like a special creationist would argue that God basically infused at different times in history new body plans, new information, and created new species. I don't know the details on that, but it seems that that's the best explanation for some of these big causal joints.
Yeah, so we have transitions within the kinds, but not from one kind to another. Fossil record simply does not bear out Darwin's hypothesis. There's a great quote you use in the book by Hugo de Vries, a Dutchman, I think. I think he was writing in 1905, something like that. But he said, natural selection may explain the survival of the fittest, but it cannot explain the arrival of the fittest. That's a good little turn of phrase to get in your head.
That's right. And that seems right. If you look at the contemporary intelligent design movement there, while you're right, that was 1904, 1905 that DeVries said that, that's still the same kind of idea that's driving much of the ID movement. And the question is, like, how much can the natural selection, that mechanism, that naturalistic mechanism, how much can that really do? And I think the consensus, at least a consensus, is that it can improve existing kinds, but it can't get you new information, right? And that's why there's this sort of revolution in evolution. You do have neo-Darwinians, but you also have non-Darwinian versions of evolution where they're looking for other mechanisms besides natural selection that can account for the rapid increase in information that you see in the fossil records. And that's just kind of an interesting shift, right? A couple of years ago, there was a meeting in the Royal Society of London where, you know, biologists were basically admitting that neo-Darwinian mechanisms just can't get you the kind of information we need in evolution. And you'd think, like, that's a good thing. Oh, maybe they'll all look to God. But that wasn't what happened, right? Because that would be irrational. That would be unscientific, is what we're told. So what they did is it just began to look for other naturalistic mechanisms. And so now you've got a whole menu, you know, 15 to 20 naturalistic mechanisms. And individually or together, those are the mechanisms on the non-Darwinian approaches to evolution that can get us the new information. Intelligent design folks, I think, have done a really good job exploring those. And their argument, which seems plausible to me, is that those additional mechanisms also come up short.
One of the things you point out in the book, and I think it's something that's worth expanding on, is that we suffer in the modern world from nature deficit, or from maybe we could call it light pollution, where we're stuck in an environment where we really don't see nature, the very lady nature that points us towards a supreme designer.
Right. Yeah, this is this idea that we continue to buffer ourselves and further remove ourselves from reality. And you might think that, like, what's the problem with that, right? Isn't air conditioning and a good thing? And of course it is. But what happens is that so much of modern life, we're mediating our lives through technology and we're living in comfortable homes. I mean, I'm talking to you today from my house here. And what happens, though, is we no longer see the world properly, right? And if part of our job is Christians now is to help others see the world as it is so that they can rightly see the creator behind the world, it's just going to make our job more difficult. Yeah. And so that was what's going on there is given the fact that, you know, even this statistic about how many creatures have become extinct, even what we do see in the world is just a mere fraction of the amazing reality that is the world that God created. And so, yeah, I wanted to help people see things freshly, and we have to jar them a little bit.
You have to kind of open your eyes and see that we live in an amazing universe on an an amazing planet. With respect to human beings, in chapter 4, you asked the question, can materialism account for the human mind? And I think that's a salient question. The mind and the brain, substance dualism, which I hold to, we say that the mind and the brain are not identical. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, they're correlated, they're tightly integrated, but they're not the same thing. That's right.
Yep. So in golf, oftentimes I say the mind is so incredibly significant because the mind causes the physical synapses of the brain to fire. So where your mind is really has a big impact on how well you play a sport, for example. But yeah, substance dualism, I think, is a really important point. But Daniel Dennett, he said this, if naturalism is true, then there are no conscious minds. Naturalism is true, therefore, there are no conscious minds. So he would say everything's molecules in motion. There is no such thing as a metaphysical reality like the mind.
Right. So, you know, I picked Dennett. He's not the only, he's one strand of the non-religious
story. He's an easy target.
In some ways, he's an easier target, but he's also a prominent voice and a prominent view. What's so interesting, even, you know, this book just came out, but there's a kind of movement in philosophy of mind to what you would call mind-first views of reality, because they're realizing, like, the Dennetts of the world, the atheists, sort of old guard atheists, right, who, like, Russell would be in the stream, Bertrand Russell, and Daniel Dennett's part of maybe the, what for a time were called the new atheists, that are very, you know, hold to a scientism and materialism or physicalism and all those things. That's kind of shifting in the academy, in kind of my sense of it, because of the very argument that you read there. It just seems obviously false, right? That consciousness is an illusion, right? And if the first premise that you read there was, if naturalism is true, there are no conscious minds, right? And then premise two, naturalism is true, right? Well, then I would just say there are conscious minds, therefore it's not the case that naturalism is true, right? That seems like more plausible, given the fact that I think we have good reasons to think that I am, and you are, and we are conscious agents. So yeah, I wanted to look at Dennett, but there is an interesting shift that's taking place in the academy because they realize how hard it is to get minds from purely physical things. David Chalmers, who's a leading philosopher of mind, coined the problem of the consciousness as the really hard problem, right? How do you get mental creatures from material things? And that's the real hard problem. And Dennett, of course, is tackling that by denying the phenomena. And that just seems crazy to me.
I had a guest on a few weeks ago, and one of the things he kept pressing is that we should never let anyone try to talk us out of our deep-seated intuitions. And, you know, this is one of those intuitions. You kind of know we have conscious minds, and conscious minds point us to a conscious creator.
Yeah. Or at least it's, yeah, it seems like a better fit, right? Because on theism, it's mind first, right? Before there was the physical universe, there was capital R reason, as Lewis puts in his book on miracles, or, you know, there's capital M mind, right? Mind is prior to matter on the theistic view. On the naturalistic story, it's, you know, in the beginning there was matter, and then somehow minds are late and local. Is, I love this phrase. Thomas Nagel wrote a book in 2012 called Mind and Cosmos. He used this wonderful phrase, you know, eventually the universe woke up, right? Eventually this universe was such that minds evolved. And he's right. Like, where did minds come from? And Nagel, even in his book Mind and Cosmos, says you can't get minds from a purely naturalistic Darwinian universe. And that's why Nagel and many others are moving to this middle view, that's a mind-first view of reality, that says at the fundamental level of physics, these BBs, whatever they are, whatever the fundamental particles turn out to be, are bits of mental things, right? Because you can't get mental things from physical things. So you need to build the mental things into the foundation of reality itself. So you have this huge shift now, because of the really hard problem, I think, is so intractable. So that's kind of an interesting move that's taking place in the academy right now.
Another signpost is morality. A quick question, is there a moral order? Is the moral order that is objective?
Yeah, that was one of the questions that I think is important to explore. And I think, and the answer that I arrive at is yes, there is an objective moral order. And I think you can see that by the pure light of reason, like you just mentioned, you know, your guest who says, don't let people talk you out of your deeply held intuitions. I think Lewis wonderfully said in his book, Miracles, we can see by the light of reason that we ought to love our neighbor, right? We don't need a syllogism or somebody to teach us that. And I think that's true. We can just see by the light of reason that there is objective moral values and that there are objective moral duties in the universe, right? And in the book, I run through a bunch of what are sometimes called intuition pumps or thought experiments that you can give to see this. But yeah, I think it's pretty clear that there is objective morality. So then the question becomes, what best explains it? And that's kind of where I took it in that chapter.
Yeah. Can atheism account for the guilt that we feel when we do something wrong?
That's right. I think that, you know, the three or four options that I considered in the book for what best explains or grounds objective morality are the universe, nothing, or God, actually. So I guess it was three. And I think that if I were not a theist, if I didn't think that theism offered the best explanation, I would probably go with nothing. What explains objective morality? Nothing does. It's just a brute fact. This is Eric Weilenberg's view. He adopts a view that's sometimes called Platonic atheism. Sometimes it's called brute fact atheism. And I think I would just go there, right? What explains it? Nothing does. It's just a part of the furniture of the world, right? And there's no explanation for it. I think that's the best thing. But notice what that doesn't account for. One of these fundamental features of the moral life that you just brought up. The fact that we feel guilt when we do wrong.
We'll have to stop here for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Join us again next time when we'll continue Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with philosopher Paul Gould. Our firm commitment here at the Christian Research Institute is to defend the faith once for all delivered to the saints and equip believers to become true disciples of Jesus Christ. In appreciation for your vital gift to help strengthen and expand CRI's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches, Hank would like to send you a copy of A Good and True Story, 11 Clues to Understanding Our Universe and Your Place in It by Dr. Paul Gould. Call a resource consultant at 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or visit our website, equip.org. That's equip.org. You can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters. Life matters more. Dr. Eben Alexander's wildly popular near-death experience book, Proof of Heaven, assures us that no matter what we do in this life, only unconditional love and joy await us in the world to come. But our Lord warned that while the gate to hell is wide, the road to it broad, and those who enter through it are many, the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few. Your generous support lets Hank Hanegraaff and CRI speak out against the lies that lead to hell. In appreciation for your gift today, we'll rush you Hank's book, Afterlife, What You Need to Know About Heaven, the Hereafter, and Near-Death Experiences, filled with answers to your questions about life after death. Call 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org now. Again, that's equip.org.